Then I said yes. She started screaming, so excited. I said, come on out here, honey. Let's get hitched.
It Girl, 1972-1974. Determined to make a name for herself outside of the Sunset Strip, Daisy Jones started writing her own songs. Armed with only a pen and paper and no musical training whatsoever, Daisy created a songbook that soon grew to include rough sketches of over 100 songs. One night during the summer of 72, Daisy attended a Mi Vida show at the Ash Grove. She was dating Mi Vida frontman Jim Blades at the time. Toward the end of the set, Jim invited Daisy onto the stage to do a cover of Son of a Preacher Man with the band.
Simone. Daisy had grown her hair out really long by then, gotten rid of her bangs. She always wore hoop earrings, and she never wore shoes. She was just very cool. That night at the Ash Grove, she and I were sitting in the back, and Jim tried to get her to go up there, and she kept saying no. But he kept at it most of the night, and eventually, Daisy got on that stage.
Daisy, it was a surreal feeling. All of those people looking at me, expecting something to happen.
When she started singing with Jim, she was kind of timid about it, which surprised me. But I could feel her getting more and more into it as the song went on. And then somewhere around the second chorus, she just let it rip. She was smiling, she was happy up there, and people couldn't take their eyes off of her. By the time they got toward the end, Jim had stopped singing and just let her go. She brought the house down.
Jim Blades, lead singer of Mi Vida. Daisy had this incredible voice. It was gritty but never scratchy. You'd have thought she had rocks in her throat that the sound had to travel over. It made everything she sang complex and interesting and kind of unpredictable. I've never had much of a voice myself. You don't have to have a great voice to be a singer if your songs are good enough, but Daisy had the whole thing going, man. She was always singing from deep in her belly. It takes people years to learn something like that, and Daisy just did it naturally, did it singing in the car next to you or folding the laundry. I was always trying to get her to sing with me, and she always said no until that night at the Ash Grove. I think she finally agreed to sing in public because of how bad she wanted to be a songwriter. I told her the biggest thing your songs have going for them is that you might sing them. Her biggest asset was that people couldn't take their eyes off her. I told her to use that.
I felt like Jim was basically saying that nobody cared what I was singing about as long as they could get a good look at me. Jim always made me mad.
If memory serves, Daisy threw her lipstick at me. But when she calmed down, she asked me where she should try to play some gigs.
I wanted to get my songs heard, so I started singing a bit around L.A. I'd sing a few of my songs, do some stuff with Simone.
Greg McGinnis? You know, Daisy was dating everybody. Like, man, when that fight broke out between Tick Yoon and Larry Hapman outside Licorice Pizza, and Tick busted Larry's eyebrow open, that was crazy stuff. I was there. I'd been buying my Dark Side of the Moon LP. So, when was that? Late 72, maybe early 73? I looked outside and Tick's got Larry in a headlock and people said they were fighting over Daisy. Plus, I'd heard Dick Poehler and Frankie Bates had both tried to get her to record a demo and she'd turned them down.
Suddenly, there were so many people trying to convince me to do a demo. All these guys wanted to be my manager. But I knew what that meant. LA is full of men just waiting for some naive girl to believe their bullshit. Hank Allen was the least smarmy. He was the one that I could tolerate the most. By that point, I had moved out of my parents' house and into the Chateau Marmont. I'd rented a cottage in the back, and Hank was at my door all the time, leaving messages. He was the only one not just talking about me, but also about my songs. I said, all right, if you want to manage me, you can manage me.
Simone, when I met Daisy, I was the older, wiser, cooler one. By the early 70s, Daisy was it. I remember I was in her room at the Marmont one time, and I'm looking in her closet, and I see all these Halston wraps and jumpsuits. I said, where did you get all these Halstons? She said, oh, they sent them over. I said, who did? She said, somebody at Halston. This was a girl that hadn't ever released a single piece of work. No album, no single. But she was in the magazines and photos with rock stars. Everybody loved her. I took some of those Halstons, though.
I went over to Larrabee Sound to record the demo Hank wanted me to record. I think it was a Jackson Browne song. Hank wanted me to sing the song really sweet, and I wasn't feeling it. I sang it the way I wanted to, a little bit rough, a little bit breathy. Hank said, can we please just do one take where you sing it smooth, maybe a key higher? I grabbed my purse and said, nope, and I left.
She got signed to Runner Records right after that.
I didn't care about anything but songwriting. The singing was okay, but I didn't want to be some puppet up there singing other people's words. I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to sing my own stuff.
Daisy doesn't value anything that comes easy to her. Money, looks, even her voice. She wanted people to listen to her.
I signed the deal with Runner Records, but I didn't read the contract. I didn't want to read contracts and pay attention to who I was supposed to pay what money to and what was expected of me. I wanted to write songs and get high.
They scheduled her for a kickoff meeting, and I went over to her place and we put together the perfect outfit. Went through her songbook to get it just right. When she left to go over there that morning, she was walking on air. But however many hours later, she showed up at my place, and I could tell something was wrong. I said, what's going on? She just shook her head and walked right past me. She went into my kitchen, grabbed the bottle of champagne we'd bought to celebrate, popped it open, and walked into my bathroom. I followed her in there, and she was running herself a bath. She stripped off her clothes and got in the tub, took a swig right from the bottle. I said, talk to me. What happened? She said, they don't care about me. I guess at the meeting they'd handed her a list of songs they expected her to do, and it was stuff from the catalog, leaving on a jet plane kind of stuff. I said, what about your own songs? She said, they don't like my songs.
They read through my entire book and couldn't find one song in there. Not one song they thought I should record. I said, what about this one? And this one? And this one? I was at that conference table with Rich Palantino and I was flipping through that book, panicked. I was thinking they must not have read them. They just kept saying the songs weren't ready yet. That I wasn't ready to be a songwriter.
She got drunk in the tub and all I could do was just make sure that when she passed out, I pulled her out and put her in bed, which is what I did.
I got up the next morning and went back to my own place. Tried to put it out of my mind by laying by the pool. When that didn't work, I smoked a few cigarettes, did a few lines in my cottage. Hank came over and tried to calm me down. I said, get me out of this. And he kept telling me I didn't want to get out of it. I said, yes, I do. He said, no, you don't. I got so mad. I ran out of my own place faster than Hank could catch me. I drove right over to Runner Records. I was in the parking lot before I realized I was still in a bikini top and jeans. I went right into Rich Palantino's office and ripped up the contract. Rich just laughed and said, Hank called and said you might do that. Honey, that's not how contracts work.
Daisy was Carole King. She was Laura Nero. Hell, she could have been Joni Mitchell. And they wanted her to be Olivia Newton-John.
I went back to the Marmot. I'd been crying. I had mascara running down my face. Hank was waiting for me, sitting on my stoop. He said, "Why don't you sleep it off?" I said, "I can't sleep. I've had too much Coke and too many Dexies." He said he had something for me. I thought he was going to hand me a Quaalude, like that was going to do anything. But he gave me a Secanol. I was out like a light, and I woke up feeling so much better. No hangover, nothing. For the first time in my life, I was sleeping like a baby. From then on, it was Dexies to get through the day, Reds to get through the night, champagne to wash it all down. The good life, right? Except the good life never made for a good life. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Debut, 1973 to 1975. The six settled into life in Los Angeles, renting a house in the hills of Topanga Canyon. They prepared to begin recording their debut album. Teddy, along with a team of technicians, including lead engineer Artie Snyder, set up shop at Sound City Studios, a recording studio in Van Nuys, California.
Karen, the day we moved into that house, I thought, this place is a dump. It was this rickety old thing with the front door off the hinges and chipped stained glass windows. I hated it. But about a week or two later, Camila got to L.A. She drove down the long driveway through the woods, and she got out of the car, and she went, "Wow, this place is bitchin'." Once she said the house was cool, I started to dig it.
Camila. The house was surrounded by rosemary bushes. I loved that.
Billy. Man, it felt good to have Camila back. It felt so good to have that woman in my arms again. We were going to get married, and I was in L.A., and I was making a record with my brother, and everything felt like it was gold.
Warren. Graham and Karen each had a bedroom off the kitchen. Pete and Eddie took the garage. Billy and Camila wanted the loft, so I got the only bedroom with a bathroom in it.
Graham. Warren's bedroom had a toilet in it. He used to say he had his own bathroom, but he didn't. His room had a toilet, just in the corner of the room.
Billy. Teddy was a night owl. So we would all head out to the studio in the afternoon and stay pretty late into the night, sometimes into the morning. When we were recording, you know, the rest of the world didn't exist to us. You're in that dark studio thinking of nothing but the music. Me and Teddy, we were knee-deep in it, speeding up tempos and recording in different keys, trying out everything. I was playing around with new instruments. I was lost to it all at the studio, but then I'd come home and Camila would be asleep, sheets around her. I'd be a little drunk, usually, and I'd slip into bed right next to her. It was always the mornings that I got to spend with Camila back then. The way most couples go out to dinner at the end of a long day, Camila and I would go out to breakfast. Some of my favorite mornings were the ones where I wouldn't even bother going to sleep. Camila would wake up, and two of us would drive on down to Malibu and have breakfast along PCH. Every morning, she'd order the same thing, an iced tea, no sugar, 3 lemon slices.
Camila. Iced tea, 3 lemons. Club soda, 2 limes. Martini with 2 olives and an onion. I'm particular about my drinks. I'm particular about a lot of things.
Karen. You know, people think of Camila as following Billy everywhere, taking care of Billy all the time, but it wasn't like that. She was a force to be reckoned with. She got what she wanted almost all the time. She was persuasive and kind of pushy, although you never really realized you were being pushed. But she was opinionated and knew how to get her way. I remember this one time she and Billy came down into the living room one morning, just a bit before noon, maybe. We were all in last night's jeans, that kind of thing. We weren't going into the studio until much later. Camila said, "You all want to make a big breakfast? Pancakes, waffles, bacon, eggs, the whole nine?" But Billy had heard that Graham and I were going to get a burger and he wanted to go with us. So Camila said, "I'll just make you all burgers here." And we said, "Fine." So she sent Billy out for hamburger meat and told him to get bacon too, and eggs for tomorrow. Then she fired up the grill and came in to tell us the burger meat Billy got didn't look so good, so she'd just make bacon. And while she was making bacon, might as well make eggs. And if she had the eggs out, she might as well make some pancakes too. Suddenly, it was 1:30 and we were all sitting around the table to eat a brunch and there wasn't a single burger in sight. All of it tasted great and no one even noticed what she had done except me. That's what I loved about her. She was no wallflower. You just had to be paying attention to see it.
Eddie. The rest of us were always gone, most of the time at least. And I just assumed Camila might help around the house, might clean a bit, you know what I mean? I said one time, maybe while we're gone, you could tidy up or something.
Camila. I said, all right. And then I proceeded to not clean a single thing.
Graham. It was a busy time. Billy was always writing. We were always working on some element or another, in and out of the studio, sleeping there sometimes. So many nights Karen and I would stay up until the sun came up, working on a riff or a melody.
Warren. That was when I grew my mustache. See, now, some men just can't pull off a mustache, but I can. I grew it when we were recording our first album, and I have never shaved it. Well, I shaved it one time, and I looked like a skinned cat, so I grew it back.
Recording an album, especially a debut, it takes a lot out of you. Billy became a little obsessive. I think that's why when the rest of us might have done a bump in the studio, I think that's why Billy started doing lines every day. He was staying in the zone.
I was intent on making sure that album was the greatest album anyone had ever released since the dawn of time. Let's just say I wasn't known for keeping things in perspective back then.
Billy took a lot of control over that album, and Teddy let him. Billy would write the songs, write almost everybody's parts. He'd come in and he'd know the guitars and the keys and what he wanted on the drums. He wasn't on Pete as much. He let Pete have a little bit more leeway. But the rest of us, he dictated the sound, and we all went along with it. I kept looking at everybody else, wondering if someone was going to say something, but no one did. It seemed like I was the only one that cared. And when I'd push back, Teddy would back Billy.
Artie Snyder, lead engineer for the 6, 7, 8, 9, and Aurora. Teddy thought Billy was the real talent of the 6. He never said that to me directly, but he and I spent a lot of time in the control room over the years, and we'd go out sometimes after the band went home, have a drink or two, get a burger. Teddy was a guy who could eat. You'd say, "Let's get drinks," and Teddy would say, "Let's get steaks." What I mean is, I knew him well. And he really singled Billy out. He asked his opinion when he didn't ask anyone else's, looked at Billy when he was talking to the whole band. Don't get me wrong, all of them were talented. I once used one of Karen's tracks as an example to another keyboardist of what he should be doing. And I once heard Teddy tell another producer that Pete and Warren were going to be the best rhythm section in rock one day. So he believed in all of them. But he homed in on Billy. One night as we were walking to our cars, Teddy said Billy was the one that had what you can't teach. And I think that's true. I still think that's true.
Graham. Billy was always wondering if we should lay it down one more time, if we should mess with the mix more. Teddy kept telling us that he wanted to leave it as raw as possible. Teddy spent real energy trying to get Billy just to be Billy.
Teddy told me once, "What your sound is a feeling. That's it. And that's a world above everything else." I remember saying, "What's the feeling?" And I was writing about love. I was singing with a little bit of a growl. We were rocking hard on the guitars with some real blues bass lines. So I was thinking Teddy might say, you know, taking a girl home from a bar or speeding with the top down or something like that. Something fun, maybe, a little dangerous. But he just said, it's ineffable. If I could define it, I wouldn't have any use for it. That really stuck with me.
Karen. It was pretty boss recording an album with a real studio. There were techs around to tune everything, people around getting lunch, somebody to go grab you a dime bag. Every day there was a large spread for lunch that got changed out for dinner. This one time we were recording, and in comes a dozen chocolate chip cookies delivered by some dude. I said, we have enough cookies, and the kid said, not this kind. They were laced. I have no idea who sent them.
Eddie. Just One More was written and recorded in one day when somebody sent over a batch of grass baked into cookies. The whole song, written mostly by Billy with my help, seems like it's about wanting to sleep with a girl one time before you hit the road. But it was about how we'd eaten all the grass and just wanted one more cookie.
Warren. I took three of the cookies myself, and I hid one of them for later, and as Billy is writing this song about wanting one more, I thought, shit. He knows I have one more.
Graham. It was just a great time. We had a great time back then.
Billy. It did have that kind of feeling where, you know, you're in a time of your life you'll remember forever.
The night before we finished recording, I came home from somewhere or other and found Karen sitting up on the railing of the deck looking out into the canyon. Warren was in a patio chair, whittling what looked like a skinny Christmas tree out of a plastic spoon. Karen turned to me and said, it's a shame the water's up to my ankles. I wanted to go for a hike. And so I said, what are you guys on, and is there any more?
It was mescaline.
That night, when Graham, Karen, and I did peyote, I remember telling myself that if the album was shit, I was going to be okay. Because I could make spoons for a living. That logic wasn't sound, obviously, but the thought did stick with me. You can't put all your eggs in one basket.
We finished recording everything in November, I think.
We finished up around March.
Now, it was probably another month, maybe two, that Billy and Teddy were in the studio going over the mixes. I would go on some days, listen to what they were doing. I had some thoughts, and Billy and Teddy always heard me out. And then they played us the final mix, and I was blown away.
No one was allowed in the studio except Teddy and Billy. They were working on that thing for months. And then finally, we were all allowed to hear it. But it was dynamite. I said to Pete, I said, we sound fucking great.
Billy. We played it for Rich Palantino in the conference room over at the Runner offices. I was tapping my foot so hard underneath that table, I was nervous. This was our shot. If Rich didn't like it, I was thinking I might explode.
Warren. To us back then, Rich was this old guy in his suit and tie. I thought, this corporate fucker is judging me? He looked like such an agent of the man.
Graham. I had to stop watching Rich and just close my eyes and listen. And when I did, I thought, there's no way this guy isn't gonna dig this.
The last note of When the Sun Shines on You played, and I was staring at Rich. Graham and Teddy are staring, too. We're all staring at him. Rich gets this small smile on his face, and he goes, you've got a great album here. And when Rich liked it, that was it. It was like the last bit of me that was grounded down to earth just flew off, like someone had pulled the ripcord, and I was flying.
Nick Harris, rock critic. Their self-titled debut was a respectable entrance into the rock scene. It was straight-laced and economical, sort of a no-frills blues rock album from a band that knew how to write a decent love song and had really perfected the art of the drug innuendo. A little bit folky, very catchy, lots of swagger, big riffs, hard drums, and that great Billy Dunn smooth growl. It was an auspicious start.
After an album cover shoot, industry events, an interview with Cream magazine, and big early buzz for the album, Runner Records and Rod Reyes started planning a 30-city tour.
Billy, everything was happening so fast, and I was... You're an underdog for so long, and then one day you're not. And when you start to feel real success, when you start to live large and all that, you have to stop and ask yourself if you think you really deserve it. Anyone that isn't a complete asshole will come up with the answer, no, because of course you don't. When guys you grow up with are working three jobs, or they're lost overseas like we lost Chuck, of course you don't deserve it. You have to learn how to reconcile those two things, having it and not deserving it. Or you do what I did and refuse to think about it. That's why I was eager to get on the road, to start touring. When you're on the road, you don't really have to deal with real life. It's almost like hitting the pause button.
Eddie, we were headed out on a big tour, you know what I'm saying? Getting interviewed in cool places, getting our own bus. It felt good. It felt real good.
The night before we were getting on the bus, Camila and I, we were laying in bed, tangled up in the sheets, and she had grown her hair out even longer by that point. God, I could just get lost in that hair. Her hair and her hands always smelled kind of earthy, kind of herbal. She used to grab rosemary branches and crush them up in her hands and then run her hands through her hair. Every time I smell rosemary, even now, it's like I am instantly back there, stupid and young, living in a house in the canyon with my band and my girl. And that night, the one before we left, I just kept smelling the rosemary in her hair. It was then, right before I was going to leave for the tour in the morning, that she told me.
I was 7 weeks pregnant.
Karen. Camila wanted kids. Me, I always knew kids weren't in the cards for me. I think it's a feeling you get. I think you have it in your heart or you don't. And you can't put it in your heart if it's not there. And you can't pull it out of your heart if it is. And it was in Camila's heart.
Billy, I was happy at first, I think, or I was trying really hard to be happy about it. I think I knew I was happy about it. I was just so scared, it was all I could see. I started focusing on whatever I could to make it make sense. I decided that we needed to get married right away. We'd been planning to have a wedding sometime after the tour, but I decided we needed to do it right then. I don't know why that mattered to me, but the moment I knew she was pregnant, I felt like we had to make sure we were a proper family.
Karen knew an ordained minister. She got his number from a friend of hers, and we called him late that night. He came right over.
It was 4 a.m.
Karen decorated the porch out back.
I strung strips of aluminum foil all through the trees. Doesn't sound great in the context of all the environmental shit now. It looked really pretty in my defense. It swayed with the wind and it bounced the light of the moon.
Graham. Warren had some Christmas lights in his drum kit because he liked to light up his toms. I asked if we could use them, and he gave me some guff about how he had already packed them up. I said, Warren, get me your lights now before I tell everyone what an asshole you are.
It wasn't my problem Billy and Camila decided to get married in the middle of the night.
By the time Graham and I were done with it, it looked pretty far out. Almost like the sort of place you'd want to get married, even if you had forever to plan it.
Billy. As Camila was getting dressed, I went into the bathroom and I looked at myself in the mirror. I just kept telling myself I could do it. I can do this. I can do this. I walked down to the patio and then Camila came down in a white t-shirt and a pair of jeans.
She had on a yellow crochet top. She looked so pretty.
I wasn't nervous at all.
I had one piece of film left in my Polaroid, so I took a photo. I accidentally cut off their heads. You can just see Camila's legs and her hair down her back. You can see Billy's chest a bit. They are holding hands in the picture, facing each other. I was so mad I missed their faces, but I was also tripping balls.
Camila said something about loving Billy no matter what he did. Something about them with this baby being a team. But she said it like they were a real sports team. I looked over and Pete was crying. He was trying to hide it, but it was obvious. There were tears in his eyes. I think I gave him a look like, seriously? And he just shrugged.
Pete cried the whole damn time. That guy cracked me up.
Camila said, I remember just how she said it. She said, it's us, our team, forever and always, and I will always root for us. But there was this voice in my head that was telling me I shouldn't be anybody's father. I couldn't quiet it. It just kept reverberating in my head. You're gonna fuck it all up. You're gonna fuck it all up.
Look, as a man without a dad, you don't have the foggiest idea what you're supposed to do, and you don't have anyone to ask. I got it later, when I had my own kids. It's like being the first in the line, cutting down the path with a machete. Just the word dad. This word that we equated with deadbeat, asshole, alcoholic. Now it described Billy, too. He was supposed to find a way to make that word fit onto him. At least when I went through it, I had Billy to look to. Back then, Billy didn't have anybody.
The voice kept saying, if you don't have a father, how can you be a father? That voice. That was the beginning of a bad time, where I was not myself. Actually, no, I don't like putting it that way. Because you're never not yourself. You're always you. It's just, sometimes who you are is a shitty person.
They kissed each other and I could tell Camila was tearing up. Billy picked her up into his arms. He ran her upstairs and we all laughed. I paid the minister guy because Billy and Camila forgot to.
I remember laying there in that bed with Camila right after we got married. And I just wanted to leave. I kept waiting for it to be time to get on the bus because I just couldn't face her. I knew she'd be able to tell what was going on inside my head if she got too good a look at my face. I wasn't good at lying to her. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing, and people think lying is all bad, but I don't know. Lying protects people sometimes. I laid there as the sun came up and I heard the bus pull in and I jumped out of bed and kissed her goodbye.
I didn't want him to go, but I also would never have let him stay.
Graham. When I got up in the morning, Billy was already standing there outside the bus, talking to Rod.
We were all loaded up, and the bus driver pulled out of the driveway, and Camila had just run down to the front stoop in her nightgown. She'd rushed down to wave goodbye. I waved back, but I had a hard time looking at her.
He was very hard to read that morning, that bus ride.
That night we pulled into Santa Rosa. We started getting ready for our show at Inn of the Beginning, but I wasn't in the right mind.
Eddie, our first show of the tour did not go well, and there was no reason for it to go poorly except that we just weren't in sync the way we should have been, you know? Billy reversed two of the verses on Born Broken, and then Graham came in late on a bridge.
Karen, I wasn't too worried about it, but you could tell Billy and Graham were upset about how it went.
Afterward, we went back to the hotel. Girls started pouring into the room. There's a loaded bar there for us. I had more to drink than I should have. I had a highball glass in one hand, the bottle of Cuervo in the other, and just kept pouring myself a new glass. New glass, new glass, new glass. I remember Graham telling me to slow it down, but there was too much running through me. I was going to be a father, and I was a husband, and Camila was back in L.A., and we had just played this awful show, and our album had just come out, and we didn't know how it would do. Tequila quieted the whole thing down. So when Graham told me to stop, I wasn't going to listen. And, you know, there's coke lying around, and I'm doing that, and somebody's got Quaaludes. I grab a few of those.
Warren. We were in two adjoining rooms at this motel, and I was getting into it with this girl over in the corner of the one room. Cool chick, she was wearing a scarf as a shirt, and all of a sudden she jumped up and asked where her sister was. I didn't even know she had a sister with her. Somebody called out, "I think she's with Billy."
Sometime around 3 or 4 in the morning, I think I blacked out. When I woke up, I was in the hotel bathtub. I wasn't alone. There was a blonde girl laying on top of me. I'm so embarrassed to be telling you this, but it's true. I got up and puked.
Graham. When I woke up, I saw Billy standing out in the parking lot smoking a cigarette. He was pacing, back and forth, kind of talking to himself, looked a little crazy. I went out there and he said, "I fucked up, I fucked it all up." I knew what had happened. I tried to stop it, but there was no stopping him. I said, "Just don't do it again, man, that's all. Just don't do it again." He nodded and he said, "Yeah."
I called Camila just to hear her voice. I knew I couldn't tell her what I'd done. I told myself that I would never do it again, and that's what was important.
You're asking me if I knew he was going to be unfaithful, as if that's a thing that you know or you don't know. Like it's black and white. But it's not. You suspect, then you sort of unsuspect. Then you suspect again. Then you tell yourself you're crazy. Then you ask yourself whether fidelity is really something you value above all else. Let me put it this way. I've seen a lot of marriages where everyone is faithful and no one is happy.
At the end of the call, Camila said she had to go, and I said, "All right." And then I remember she said, "Okay, honey, we love you." And I said, "We?" And she said, "Me and the baby." Not just, I think I hung up the phone before I could even say goodbye.
Karen, Camila had become my friend. I hated Billy for putting me in a position to either tell Camila what he'd done or lie to her.
Drinking, drugging, sleeping around, it's all the same thing. You have these lines you won't cross, but then you cross them. And suddenly you possess the very dangerous information that you can break the rule, and the world won't instantly come to an end. You've taken a big, black, bold line, and you've made it a little bit gray. Now every time you cross it again, it just gets grayer and grayer until one day you look around and you think, "There was a line here once, I think."
It got to be a rhythm. Get to town, sound check, play, party, get on the bus. And the better we started playing, the more we partied. Hotels, girls, drugs, over and over. Hotels, girls, drugs. For all of us. But especially Billy.
We had a rule back then. We each had 5 matchsticks. That's how we'd invite people back to the party after. If they had a matchstick, they were in. We could give them out to any girl in the crowd we saw. Obviously, we tried to steer clear of weirdos.
Rod. Let me tell you what it means to manage a rock band. We're driving all over hell and creation, roadies and crew and the whole nine. And not one person, not one member of that band asked themselves how we were always stocked up on gas. End of 73 was the oil crisis. There was a gas shortage. The tour manager and I are bribing gas station attendants like our lives depend on it. I'm switching out license plates, and no one even notices because they're all sleeping around and drunk and high.
Karen, Billy turned into someone I didn't recognize on that tour. He'd pass out in the bus with a girl under his arm, invite girls with us from one city to another.
Eddie. I mean, Billy had one of the roadies deliver tequila and quaaludes to him at all hours of the night.
The album was doing pretty well and our tour got extended. I was talking to Camila about it and she said, "Karen, should I come join you guys?" I couldn't get the words out of my mouth fast enough. I said, "No, stay there."
Warren. Let me sum up that early tour for you. I was getting laid, Graham was getting high, Eddie was getting drunk, Karen was getting fed up, Pete was getting on the phone to his girl back home, and Billy was all 5 at once.
I was backstage after the Ottawa show, having a few beers with the Midnight Dawn guys. Graham was with me, Karen too. Pete was waiting for his girl Jenny. She was driving up from Boston. I hadn't met her by that point, because Pete was always really private. His high school girlfriend never met our parents. So I was excited to finally meet Jenny, see what all this fuss was about. And then, in she walks, tall as hell, long blonde hair, wearing this tiny little dress, and these super tall shoes, legs up to her neck, and I thought, no wonder Pete's obsessed with this girl. And then right behind her, I see Camila.
I wanted to surprise him. I missed him. I was bored. I was getting nervous. I mean, I had gotten married. I was 6 months pregnant, and I was spending the majority of my time alone in a massive old house in Topanga Canyon. There were a lot of reasons I went. But yes, one of the reasons was to see if things were okay. To see what he was up to. Of course it was.
I had told her not to come, but she didn't listen to me. She came to surprise Billy. She was just starting to show, maybe 5 months pregnant, something like that. She had on this big maxi dress, her hair pulled back.
Graham. I spotted Camila and I thought, oh no. But I kind of strolled on out the door. Once I was out of view, I booked it. I figured Billy was either on the bus or at the hotel. I wasn't sure which, but I had to take a chance. I ran the 2 blocks to the hotel. I should have chosen the bus.
She found him on the bus. Part of me wished I could have stopped her, and part of me was glad I was going to be all out in the open.
Eddie. I wasn't there, but I heard she walked in on him getting, well, I don't know how else to say it, oral sex, I guess I should say, from a groupie.
It was like I'd been playing with fire, but somehow I was genuinely surprised when I burnt myself. I remember Camila's face. She wasn't mad or hurt so much as truly shocked. She was just frozen, taking it in with no reaction. She stared at me as I scrambled to get myself presentable. The girl I was with just ran out like she didn't want to be in the middle of anything. When the door of the bus shut, I looked at Camila and I said, I'm sorry. That was the first thing I said, really the only thing I said. And that's when Camila finally seemed to process exactly what had happened, what was happening.
I believe what I said was, and, you know, earmuffs, but I believe what I said was, who the fuck do you think you are, cheating on me? You think there's a woman alive who is better than what you have?
Warren. I was outside talking to some of the crew guys, and I caught the tail end of it. I could see a bit through the windshield. It looked to me like she hit him. I think she had a bag with her, and I think she slugged him with the bag. And then the two of them left the bus.
I made him take a shower before I would say another word to him.
I wanted her to leave me. I've thought a lot about it, and that's what I've been up to. I'd been hoping she'd cut me loose. That night, Camila and I were sitting in my hotel room after I got out of the shower. I could feel myself sobering up, and I didn't like it. I pulled out a bump, and I remember Camila looked at me and said, what are you trying to do? She didn't say it in an exasperated way. She was really asking me, what was I trying to do? I didn't know how to answer her. I just shrugged, and I remember how stupid I felt, shrugging at a time like that, with a woman like that. This woman carrying my child, and I was shrugging like a 10-year-old boy. She stared at me, waiting for more of an answer, and I didn't have one. So she said, if you think I'm going to let you screw up our life, you've lost your mind. And she walked out the door.
Camila found me, and she said she was going home. Wasn't going to deal with his bullshit. She asked me to watch Billy all night. I was getting sick of watching Billy. But you don't say no to a woman like Camila, especially when she's pregnant. So I said okay. And then she said, when he wakes up, give him this letter.
I wake up, sick to my stomach, terrible headache. Feel like my eyes are bleeding. Karen is standing over me with a piece of paper. She has this pissed-off look on her face. I grab the paper and I read it. It was in Camila's handwriting. It said, "You have until November 30th, and then you're going to be a good man for the rest of your life. You got it." The baby was due December 1st.
I think I just refused to accept that he was as low as he claimed to be. I'm not saying it wasn't real, what he did. Oh, it was very real. All of it was real. I've never been so lost and scared. I was sick over it every day. And I couldn't have even told you what part of me felt the sickest. My heart hurt, and my stomach felt like it was going to turn inside out, and my head throbbed. It was very real. But that didn't mean I had to accept it.
Rod. I wasn't close with Camila, but her decision to stick with Billy wasn't so hard to understand. She'd gotten mixed up with him when he was a good guy. By the time she realized he was coming apart at the seams, she was too far in. If she wanted her baby to have a daddy, she had to fix Billy. What's not to get?
Like an idiot, I said to myself, okay, I'll just take until November 30th and get all this out of my system. Do it all now so I don't ever have to do it again. Sometimes I wonder if addicts aren't all that different from anybody else. They're just better at lying to themselves. I was great at lying to myself.
He didn't stop messing around with all of it.
The tour got extended when we picked up some shows opening for Rick Yates. It was good news. It was great exposure. The album was off to a respectable start. Senora was climbing up the charts. But yeah, Billy was off the rails, going at it double time after Camila caught him. The coke and the girls and the booze and all that. To be honest, I thought all of that was manageable. Not great, but manageable. I figured as long as he wasn't hitting the strong downers, benzos, heroin, maybe he'd be all right.
Graham, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to help him or whether to trust what he was saying to me. I felt stupid, honestly. I felt like I'm his brother. I should know what he needs. I should always be able to tell when he's high and lying about it. But I didn't know, and I felt embarrassed that I didn't always catch what he was up to.
Eddie, we were all sort of counting down the days. You know, 60 days until Billy has to get clean. Then it was 40 days, then it was 20 days.
We were in Dallas opening up for Rick Yates, and Rick was really into snorting heroin. I thought, I need to try heroin at least once. That made perfect sense to me, that it would be easier to get clean if I tried heroin. And it wasn't like I was going to use a needle. I was going to snort it. I'd had opium in the past. We all had. So when I was with Rick backstage at Texas Hall and he offered me a bump, I rolled on up and took it.
I always tell my people to stay away from benzos and heroin. People don't die staying up. They die when they go to sleep. Look at Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison. Downers kill you.
It all spiraled from there. Once he and Yates started snorting H, I lived with this dread in my belly. I tried to keep an eye on him. I kept trying to get him to stop.
When I found out he was with Yates, I called Teddy. I said, we've got a dead man walking. Teddy said he'd handle it.
No amount of advice or lectures or trying to chain somebody down ever stopped anyone who didn't want to stop in the first place.
When it got down to 10 days left and he was forgetting the words on stage, I remember thinking he was never going to clean up.
On November 28th, Teddy shows up at our show in Hartford. He's there backstage when we're done with our set. I say, what are you doing here? He says, you're going home. And he takes me by the arm and holds on to me until we're practically on the plane. Turns out Camila had gone into labor. We land and he drags me into his car and drives me to the hospital. We're double parked in a red zone in front of the lobby. Teddy says, get up there, Billy. This whole long journey, and all I had left to do was walk in the double doors. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't meet my kid like that. Teddy got out of the car and went up there himself.
Camila, I'd just spent 18 hours in labor with only my mom by my side, and I'm expecting my husband to walk in the door and straighten up. I understand now that you can't just fix yourself. It doesn't work like that. But I did expect it to work like that then. I didn't know. Well, the door opened, and it wasn't Billy. It was Teddy Price. I was so tired, and I was sweating bullets from the hormones running through me, and I was holding this tiny baby that I've just met, this girl who looks just like Billy. I decided to name her Julia. My mom was ready to take us both back with her to Pennsylvania, and I was tempted. Right then, giving up on Billy felt easier than trying to have faith. I wanted to say, tell him I'll raise this baby on my own. But I had to keep trying for what I wanted for me and my kid. So I told Teddy, tell him he can start to be a father this second or he's going to rehab now. And Teddy nodded and left.
I waited for what felt like hours outside the lobby, fiddling with the latch on the door. Teddy came down finally and said, you have a baby girl. She looks like you. Her name is Julia. I wasn't sure what to say. And then Teddy said, Camila says you have two choices. You can get your ass up there right now and be a good husband and father, or I can drive you to rehab. Those are your choices. I put my hand on the door handle and I thought, you know, I can just run. But I think Teddy knew what I was thinking because he said, Camila didn't give any other options, Billy. There are no other options. Some people can handle their booze and their dope. You can't, so it's over for you now. It reminded me of being a kid, maybe 6 or 7. I had gotten really into collecting these little matchbox cars. I was obsessed with them, but my mom didn't have enough money to get us very many, so I'd search for them on the sidewalk in case any kid lost one. Found a few that way. And then when I was playing with other boys in the neighborhood, sometimes I'd palm one or two of theirs. A few times I outright stole them from the store. My mom found my stash, and she sat me down and said, how come you can't just be happy playing with a few cars like everybody else? I never did have an answer for that. It's just not my way. That day at the hospital, I remember looking at the lobby door and seeing this man coming outside wheeling a lady with a baby. I looked at him and he just seemed like a man I didn't know how to be. I just kept thinking about walking into the hospital and looking at my kid and knowing that I was the shit deal she got. It wasn't that I didn't want to be with her. I wanted to be with her so bad. You have no idea how bad. I didn't want my girl to have to meet me. I didn't want that early into her life. I didn't want my kid to have to look up and see this man, this drunken, strung-out piece of shit, and think, this is my dad? That's how I felt. I was embarrassed to be seen by my baby. So I ran away. I'm not proud of it, but that's the truth. I went to rehab to avoid meeting my own daughter.
My mom said, honey, I hope you know what you're doing. And I think I yelled at her, but inside I was thinking, I hope I do too. You know, I've thought about this for a long time, decades. And here is what it comes down to. Here is why I did what I did. It didn't seem right to me that his weakest self got to decide how my life was going to turn out, what my family was going to look like. I got to decide that. And what I wanted was a life, a family, a beautiful marriage, a home, with him, with the man I knew he truly was. And I was going to get it, hell or high water.
Billy entered rehab in the winter of 1974. The Six canceled the few remaining dates on the rest of their tour. The other band members took some time off. Warren bought a boat and docked it off the shore in Marina Del Rey. Eddie, Graham, and Karen stayed in the Topanga Canyon house, while Pete temporarily moved to the East Coast to be with his girlfriend, Jenny Maines. Camila rented a house in Eagle Rock and settled into motherhood there. After 60 days in a rehabilitation center, Billy Dunn finally met his daughter, Julia.
I'm not sure I went to rehab for the right reasons. The shame and embarrassment and avoidance and all that, but I stayed for the right reasons. I stayed because on my second day there, the group therapist told me to stop imagining my daughter ashamed of me. He said to start thinking of what I'd need to do to believe my daughter was proud of me. I'll tell you, that stuck. I couldn't stop thinking about that one. Slowly, it became the light that was calling to me at the end of that tunnel, imagining a daughter. Imagining myself as a man my daughter would feel lucky to have. I kept working every day to get closer to being that man.
Graham, the day Billy was coming out of rehab, I picked up Camila and the baby and we drove over together. Now, Julia was the fattest baby you ever saw. It's true. I said to Camila, are you feeding her milkshakes? Biggest cheeks in the world, beer belly. Couldn't have been cuter. There was a tiny little picnic table and an umbrella outside the facility, so Camila sat there with Julia on her lap. I went in and got Billy. He was wearing the same thing he was wearing the last time I'd seen him in Hartford. But he had gained some weight. His face looked healthier. I said, are you ready? He said, yeah, but he seemed kind of unsure. I put my arm around him and I said what I figured he needed to hear. I said, you're going to be a great dad. I think I should have told him that sooner. I don't know why I didn't.
Julia was 63 days old when I met her. It's hard, even now, to not hate myself for that. But the second I met her, my God. Standing there at that picnic table with them, it was like someone just took an axe to me, just shattered all the crust. I felt raw. In the way where you can feel everything, feel it deep down into your nerves. I'd built a family. By accident, and without thinking, and without so many of the qualities that you should have to deserve a family, I think, but I had built one. And here was this tiny new person who had my eyes, who didn't know who I used to be, who only cared who I was now. I fell to my knees. I was just so grateful for Camila. I couldn't believe what I had put Camila through, and I couldn't believe that she was still standing there giving me another shot. I didn't deserve it, and I knew it. And I told her then that I would spend the rest of our life together trying to be twice as good as she deserved. I don't know that I've ever promised anyone anything as humbly and with as much gratitude in my heart as I promised her that day. I know I technically married her almost a year before, but I submitted myself to her then, forever and always. My daughter, too. I dedicated myself to both of them, to raising this girl, with my whole heart into it. As we got in the car, Camila whispered, "It's us, forever and always. Don't go forgetting that again, all right?" And I nodded, and she kissed me. And Graham drove us home.
I think you have to have faith in people before they earn it. Otherwise, it's not faith, right?
First, 1974 to 1975. By 1974, Daisy Jones had refused to show up to any of her recording sessions at the record plant in West Hollywood and was in breach of contract with Runner Records. Meanwhile, Simone Jackson, now signed with Supersight Records, was finding international success with her R&B dance hits, which would come to be seen as classics of the proto-disco genre. With her songs The Love Drug and Make Me Move, Simone was topping the dance club charts in France and Germany. As Simone set out to tour Europe the summer of 74, Daisy, was growing more and more restless.
I was spending my days getting sunburns and my nights getting high. I'd stopped writing songs because I didn't see a point to it if no one would let me record them. Hank was checking on me every day, pretending he was doting on me, but really just trying to convince me to get to the studio like I was some sort of prize horse that wouldn't race. And one day, Teddy Price shows up at my door. He was put in charge of me, I guess. He was supposed to convince me to show up to the studio. Teddy was probably in his 40s or 50s around then. British guy, really charming, kind of paternal. I open the door to see him on my doorstep, and he doesn't even say hello.